Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on March 21st. Nature is healing. A new Kerry Lake lawsuit has been filed. Kerry Lake is back in her natural habitat, court. A little more than 2 weeks after Lake finally secured a government gig, the litigious ex-candidate has been named in a federal lawsuit. On Tuesday, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty filed a complaint in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, seeking a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction, forcing Lake's new agency, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, to pay money the two plaintiffs say that they're owed. Lake, who assumed the role of special advisor at USAGM earlier this month, is named as a defendant in her official capacity. Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty provide news coverage for 47 million people in 23 countries, including many where freedom of the press has been curtailed. Their funding is approved by Congress, but on March 15th, Lake sent a letter to terminate the grant agreement for both, because, quote, it no longer effectuates agency priorities. She cited an executive order from President Donald Trump issued the day before, aimed at reducing the federal bureaucracy. Lake has bragged about swinging an axe around USAGM. On Steve Bannon's War Room, she said she'd be slimming this agency down, way down. It's going on an Olympic diet. She's fired more than 1,000 USAGM employees and ended many grant contracts, which she doesn't appear to have the legal authority to do. Lake and USAGM did not respond to Phoenix New Times' request for comment on the lawsuit. The lawsuit by Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which also names acting USAGM CEO Victor Morales as a defendant, points out that Congress appropriated their funding, and only Congress can withdraw it. In this country, Congress, not a senior advisor to the acting CEO of an agency, has the power of the purse, two outlets said in a court document. The United States Agency for Global Media is currently defying multiple acts of Congress by refusing to provide congressionally approved funds. The suit asked the court to grant a temporary restraining order to provide the organization with its promised congressionally appropriated funds through March 14th, a total of $7.4 million. Through a continuing resolution, Congress has already appropriated an additional $77 million for the media organization from March 15th to September 30th. The radio outlet said they will soon be nearly unable to operate, forced to terminate staff and leases for offices in the Czech Republic, Latvia, and Ukraine. Additionally, the organization says it will no longer be able to provide security protections to journalists who may face deportation to authoritarian countries where their security and even perhaps their lives will be at risk. Because those journalists operate in countries with regimes hostile to the press, the suit says, the grant funding is critical to protecting journalists who face harassment, abduction, and threats of assassination, and also the threat of torture and imprisonment because of their work. This is not the time to cede terrain to propaganda and censorship of America's adversaries, RFERL's president and CEO Stephen Kappas wrote in a statement. We believe the law is on our side, and that the celebration of our demise by despots around the world is premature. Lake is no stranger to court battles, though this will be her first as a government official. Arizona's infamous former news anchor has been a staple of legal filings since launching a doomed bid for governor in 2022. She persistently attempted to overturn her loss to Governor Katie Hobbs, even as she ran for Senate last year. She was also sued by former Maricopa County recorder Stephen Richer for defamation over baseless accusations that he facilitated election fraud. In November, the Arizona Supreme Court rejected Lake's last election challenge, and she settled her defamation suit with Richer, leaving her lawyers without billable hours. She now benefits from government lawyers, who should be a step up from her past attorneys, who kept getting sanctioned, but she'll likely also be the target of more litigation. That's the price of finally getting a job in government. When someone has a problem, you're the one who gets sued. Here's a story written by TJ LeHeru and posted on March 21st. Phoenix introduces police chief candidates, asks few tough questions. On Wednesday, the city of Phoenix held a public job interview. In the Phoenix City Council chamber, four men fielded questions in the hopes of becoming the next chief of one of the most troubled police departments in the country. The Phoenix Police Department has been under national scrutiny for years, with a June U.S. Department of Justice report confirming what community activists have long asserted. The DOJ found that Phoenix cops have consistently discriminated against racial minorities and used unnecessary deadly force, among other rampant constitutional violations. The next Phoenix police chief will be tasked with fixing the department and improving its perception with residents. However, the next chief likely will not have the DOJ to deal with, since there's little chance that the Trump administration will pursue a consent decree that the Biden administration sought to reform the department. But if Wednesday's forum was meant to take the measure of the men aspiring to lead the department through such important issues, it left much to be desired. The forum was public, but it was hardly community-driven. The city's staff filtered down the 340 questions submitted by community members and focused mainly on administrative concerns. The aspiring chiefs were asked about the department's shrinking staffing, improving officer mental health and well-being, and how to minimize bias in policing. More pointed questions were asked of individual candidates, including about sexual harassment allegations and the department's work with Maricopa County prosecutors to charge protesters as being part of a made-up street gang. The questions seemed tailored to the staffing side, said former State Senator Anna Hernandez, who will take a seat on the City Council next month. Hernandez did note several questions were asked toward the end of the forum that were geared toward more controversial issues. I was glad to hear a few questions around the DOJ investigation and the racial aspect of Phoenix Police's patterns, Hernandez said. Overall, I think it was kind of what I expected. Nothing too standout. The candidates' answers and language were strikingly similar and cautious across the board. That's no surprise. Police chief in a large department is a highly political position with multiple constituencies to please. The rank-and-file officers and the police union, the city council, city staff, and members of the community. Council member Carlos Galindo Elvira, who currently holds the seat Hernandez will take over in April, told New Times he was pleased with the candidates' responses. I went there with an open mind, knowing that this is an incredibly important position. I did not walk away disappointed for two reasons, Galindo Elvira said. All were in agreement that our police department has no role in being an arm for immigration enforcement, and that's the purview of the federal government. Secondly, they were all committed to continuous improvement of our police department in light of the DOJ report. The candidates. One candidate is familiar to those who have paid attention to Phoenix policing issues. Michael Sullivan has served as interim chief for 2.5 years, brought to lead the department after disgraced former chief Jerry Williams resigned. Sullivan is deeply unpopular with the rank and file. A survey released in February by the Phoenix Police Union showed that only 14% of officers thought the department was moving in the right direction. During the forum, Sullivan said he was disappointed by the results. He also noted that he received pushback internally when making changes to the department's use of force policy. But Sullivan's ability to lead the department might be an asset for those who, in light of the DOJ investigations, want to see the department make serious changes. Out of all four of them, I think Chief Sullivan was the one who talked the most about reform and community input, Hernandez said. The other candidates, whittled down from 8 semifinalists earlier this month, are Casey Johnson, a deputy chief in Oakland, California, Ed DeCastro, the current head of investigations for Phoenix Police, and Ed Wessing, the assistant chief of training at the Mesa Police Department. The DOJ report and the department's efforts to institute its own reforms and avoid independent oversight were top of mind. There is room for reform, Wessing said, and I do believe Phoenix is in a position to lead, nationally, in efforts to reform the daily operations of public safety. Johnson, whose Oakland department has been under independent oversight for his entire 23-year tenure, said, being in a prolonged oversight can really damage a police department. It crushes officer morale. Hernandez said that when it came to implementing substantive steps of accountability, all the candidates gave disappointingly vague answers. But she is especially concerned about DeCastro. From his responses, sounds like he doesn't believe the department does anything wrong, which is really concerning if we're talking about someone who wants to lead this department forward, Hernandez said. She added that Johnson seemed a little over his head and came across as nervous, which was a little shocking to see. Wessing spoke confidently throughout the forum, but carries other concerns from his past. According to a 2018 Arizona Republic story, public records showed that three sexual harassment allegations were lodged against Wessing between 2013 and the article's publication. Commander Ed Wessing has been accused of making inappropriate comments and inappropriately touching women in the department, the Republic story noted. The records relating to those allegations disappeared, according to Diana Williams, then a spokesperson for Mesa Police, who has since been promoted to command staff. When asked to explain what happened during the forum, Wessing said that there had been an investigation into his conduct in 2003 when he was a sergeant. I was exonerated of any misconduct of any type for workplace harassment, Wessing said. Wessing's response does not match the Republic's reporting. Wessing was a sergeant in 2003, but according to his LinkedIn, he was a lieutenant during the period that the Republic said the complaints were filed. Wessing mentioned only one investigation, while the Republic reported three complaints. Mesa Police spokesperson Brandy Myers said the department only received one formal complaint against then-Sergeant Wessing in 2003 for allegations of sexual harassment by another member of the department who was under internal investigation himself and was not the subject of said complaint against Wessing. After a thorough investigation into the allegations, the complaint was not substantiated, and Wessing was exonerated. A troubled department. City manager Jeff Barton will choose the next chief, though Galindo Avira said that council members have provided feedback based on their credentials and performance at the forum. Whoever wins the job will take on a department that keeps making bad headlines, even after the DOJ's report was released. The number of people killed by Phoenix police officers has been climbing in recent years. So far this year, four people have died after a run-in with Phoenix cops, including one who was running away. Phoenix police shot and killed 14 people last year and 12 in 2023, both up from 10 in 2022. In August, two officers beat Tyrone McAlpin, a deaf black man with cerebral palsy, for doing absolutely nothing. McAlpin was jailed for 24 days. He has since filed a civil rights lawsuit against the department. Such abuses have tanked trust in police among many Phoenix communities. For the most skeptical residents, it doesn't matter who takes the reins as police chief. They can put anybody there. I don't care. Unless they have an outside agency monitoring them, it's not going to change, said Salvador Reza, a longtime community organizer who crusaded against infamous former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Why are they so afraid to let an outside agency come in and monitor them? They claim they can monitor themselves, but so far they haven't proven it. They keep on killing a lot of people and abusing the citizens in many ways. Five moments you missed from the Bernie Sanders AOC rally in Tempe. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on March 20th. Thousands of people survived traffic on State Route 202, parked their cars in distant lots, and stood in snaked lines around Arizona State University's athletic facilities to see Senator Bernie Sanders in Tempe Thursday evening. More than 11,300 people came to see the Vermont senator at the Arizona stop of his Fight Oligarchy that has been barnstorming across the western United States. Sanders has mounted the speaking tour to talk directly to voters about President Donald Trump's haphazard cuts to health care, federal programs, the Department of Education, and more. Mullet Arena, where the event took place, holds only 5,000 people, so thousands more watched from an overflow lot outside. Sanders, who began the day at a rally in Las Vegas, was joined by New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The evening was filled with classic Sanders moments about how the top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%, and CEOs now make 300 times more than the average worker. It also had more uniquely Arizonan moments. Bright green over 21 wristbands were used to make up for a shortage of press wristbands, and a post-rally interview was held in the ASU hockey team's weight room. If you didn't make it or were turned away once you saw the lines, you'll have another chance when Sanders and Representative Greg Kassar hold a Tucson event on Saturday. In the meantime, here are five moments you missed from the Tempe rally. Fuck you. Sanders didn't say it, but the audience sure did. Shortly after taking the stage, Sanders wanted to make the purpose of his Arizona trip clear. We are here because we have a message for Mr. Trump, he said, taking a pause as he pointed at the audience. And that is, but before he could finish his sentence, yells of fuck you, directed at the current president, filled the air. Not quite where Sanders was going, as he soon demonstrated. We will not allow you to move this country into an oligarchy, he continued. We're not going to allow you and your friend, Mr. Musk, and the other billionaires to wreak havoc on the working families of this country. Pretty close. Dragging Kyrsten Sinema. Former independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema's name was never uttered, but Ocasio-Cortez didn't not bring her up. One thing I love about Arizonans is that you all have shown that if a U.S. senator isn't fighting hard enough for you, you're not afraid to replace her, Ocasio-Cortez said as the crowd erupted with cheers, with one who is. Once a staunch progressive, Sinema ended her time in the Senate as no friend of the far-left wing of her party. Ocasio-Cortez's comments came shortly after she and Sinema got into a small social media battle over Senate Democrats failing to use the filibuster to prevent the passage of a Republican-backed continuing resolution to keep the government open, albeit with major cuts to popular programs. Change of heart on the filibuster, I see, Sinema wrote, while posting an image of a past Ocasio-Cortez post. Still no, Ocasio-Cortez shot back. In fact, The same Dems who argued to keep the filibuster for when we need it do not, in fact, use it when we need it. It's only used to block Democratic policies, never to block harmful GOP ones. You guys have 9/11s here? One was a generation-defining atrocity, the other sell Slurpees. Easy to get them confused. Somebody goes out and robs a 9/11. You guys have 9/11s here? Sanders asked the audience, seeming to mean 7/11. The mix-up was comical, though not uncommon, and had many in press row raising an eyebrow. Sanders went on to make a point about how insurance and drug companies, as well as billionaires, are the real major criminals here. And yes, Bernie, the Valley does have 7-Elevens, but we prefer Circle K. A political rally or a classroom? Rallies are usually one-sided affairs. Those on stage speak while those in the audience listen and cheer. But Sanders called on attendees to hear about their fears, issues that they were experiencing, and how much their health insurance deductibles were. Be loud, Sanders told attendees, while pointing at folks near the podium who had their hands raised. One woman shared that she was paid yesterday but had no money today because her entire paycheck went toward paying bills. Another shared that they were afraid to protest for fear of being arrested, and someone else was scared they'd get deported. When Sanders asked the audience about their health insurance deductibles, one man repeatedly yelled $22,000 from the stands. Sanders didn't appear to hear him. Eventually, Sanders moved on. I think we could go on for many hours, he said. Calling out Schweikert. Ocasio-Cortez praised Arizona's congressional Democrats for voting against the continuing resolution, specifically giving props to Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego and Representatives Yasmin Ansari and Greg Stanton. Ansari attended the rally. Ocasio-Cortez also called out one Arizona GOP congressman for voting in favor of it. You know which Arizonan did vote to cut Medicaid and jack up health care costs? Ocasio-Cortez asked attendees. David Schweikert. Schweikert's seat is thought to be vulnerable in 2026. Massive boos filled the arena as Ocasio-Cortez continued. We need to come together and spend every day to educate for the next year and a half, working to educate other Arizonans to give Schweikert the boot, she said, and replace him. Ocasio-Cortez didn't mention Representatives Andy Biggs, Abe Hamada, and Eli Crane, who represent solidly red districts. Neither did she mention Representative Juan Ciscomani, whose southern Arizona district could flip blue during the midterms. Here's a story written by Zach Buchanan and posted on March 20th. Suns worker sues over age discrimination, rat-infested work area. In late October of 2023, Jason Cope began circulating a draft of an email among his colleagues. An employee of the Phoenix Suns, Cope had worked in the team's Suns Vision department since 2009, helping to run the in-game programming that appears on the big video boards at Phoenix Arena. For much of that time, Cope said, neither he nor many of his longtime co-workers had received raises. So, Cope drafted an email to bring the issue to management's attention and then sought buy-in from others in his department. Not enough people signed on, so he never sent the email to his bosses. But Cope believes Suns management caught wind. A few weeks later, Cope and many other Suns Vision employees received an email informing them that to continue working, they would need to sign new agreements that classified them as independent contractors. As a part-time employee with benefits, Cope would lose his benefits and the ability to earn overtime. It didn't sit right with me, Cope said. I was the last person to sign a contract because I was so against it. Cope believes his unsent email and the employment status change are connected, Additionally, he said that the roughly half dozen people transferred to contractor status are all middle-aged or older, while the team has hired younger employees on a full-time basis. Despite the change, he said his job duties and pay remain the same, leading him to believe that the Suns have discriminated against him and others because of his age. Cope is 46, and he notes that benefits for older employees tend to cost companies more to provide. Last week, Cope made those allegations in a federal lawsuit against the Suns, who he says retaliated against him, treated him worse based on his age, and forced him and his co-workers to work in a rat-infested parking garage. Cope is seeking damages. His lawsuit does not specify an amount, as well as reinstatement to his previous position and declaratory relief that his contractor agreement is null and void. Filed on March 12th, Cope's lawsuit is the latest in a string of workplace controversies with the Suns. In 2022, ESPN reported widespread allegations of racism and misogyny within the Suns under former owner Robert Sarver, who was ultimately forced to sell the team as a result. Current owner Matt Ishiba bought the team a year later, though Cope said that the environment has not changed. Last November, Andrea Trishan, the team's former manager of diversity, equity, and inclusion, whose 10-month tenure bridged the Sarver and Ishiba eras, sued the team for racial discrimination and retaliation. Cope and Trishan have the same attorney, Sherry Wright of IBF Law. Cope said that he doesn't know Trishan, but reached out to Wright after Trishan went public with her allegations last summer. When asked for a response to Cope's lawsuit, the Suns sent Phoenix New Times a statement attacking Wright, who is currently on probation with the State Bar of Arizona. This is yet another attempt by attorney Sherry Wright to engineer a lawsuit using false claims, and this time it is based on age discrimination, wrote Stacy Mitch, the senior vice president of communications for the Suns and Mercury. Ms. Wright is currently on probation by the Supreme Court of Arizona for unethical practices. This clearly defines her character, and we will not be extorted by her shameful scheme. Cope and Wright granted an interview to New Times earlier this week, after which New Times sent a second email to Mitch with specific questions about Cope's allegations. Mitch responded with the same statement, with an additional paragraph. These assertions are false, and we will have no further comment in the press, the news statement concluded. It's clear the Phoenix New Times has been coordinating with Ms. Wright for this story. We will refute accordingly in our response to the court. New Times learned of the lawsuit after it had been filed through means that are not related to Wright or her clients, and requested initial comment from Wright and the Suns at the same time. Wright offered an interview. The Suns did not. What the lawsuit says. At the crux of Cope's lawsuit is the contractor agreement he said he felt forced to sign. According to his complaint, his supervisor sent him and others in his department an email with the agreement on November 9, 2023. According to an excerpt included in the suit, the email noted that your experience scheduling and working games should not change, but that signing the agreement would be required before anyone could work another game. The next Suns home game was a day later, November 10th. Cope said some employees refused to sign the agreement and left the team, while others signed immediately. Cope said he ultimately signed it because I had no choice. I've been here since 2009. The contract left him without the legal rights and benefits he had previously enjoyed as an employee, per the complaint, while the team maintained control over every other aspect of his work. Cope said he still has a company email and phone number. Cope said about 8 Suns Vision employees were switched to contractor status, some of whom have been with the company since the 90s. He added that some have disabilities and some are nearing retirement age. Meanwhile, Cope's complaint says the team hired younger employees to perform the same duties as Cope, while he was denied employment benefits solely due to his age. What's the difference between my client, Jason, and other individuals who are older and the younger ones? Wright said in an interview. Lower pay. In August 2024, Cope made a complaint to the team's human resources department that he said led to his own suspension. During an interaction with a younger full-time employee, Cope's complaint said, the employee said, Jesus fucking Christ, do you have to be white and 40 to get any respect in this place? Cope was offended by the comment and reported it to his supervisor. Not long after, Cope was told to come to the stadium for a meeting with his boss and Joy Harper, who heads HR for the franchise. She began to say that she was doing fact-finding and that she had found that I was a disgruntled employee and that nobody on my crew liked me or wanted to work with me, Cope said. Cope's complaint says Harper characterized Cope as disgruntled about the conversion to contractor status. Harper's suggestion put him on the defensive, Cope said, and he asked why he was required to be at HR meetings if he was no longer considered an employee. His complaint says no meaningful attempt was made to address the comment, he reported, and that he was instead given a 3-month suspension, an action that was clearly motivated by Cope's protected activity in reporting discriminatory behavior, the complaint says. Cope said he assumed he'd never work for the Suns again. I left there crying, he said. He has since continued to work Suns games and other events at the arena. Cope's complaint also alleges that the Suns subjected him and others, both employees and contractors, to unsafe working conditions by failing to curb a rat infestation. Most recently, the rats were an issue in his department's current work area, which is now located in the parking structure below the arena, where employees are forced to use portable toilets. Wright's firm shared photos with Phoenix New Times that Cope said he took of dead rats in traps and rat feces on the ground. Cope said the rats have now migrated to another part of the stadium. There's still the leftover poop, he said, but it doesn't smell like ammonia anymore. Sherry Wright background. The Sun statement about Cope's lawsuit focused more on Wright, whose run-ins with the state bar were enumerated in a December article in the Arizona Republic. In January 2022, the Arizona Supreme Court gave her a year of probation for trying to get a family court judge removed from a case over alleged racial bias without a good faith basis in law or fact. In August 2024, she was given 2 years of probation over numerous ethical violations in dealings with 3 different clients, including failing to communicate with clients, failing to comply with a court order, and disclosing a confidential piece of information about a past client. Wright admitted the violations when she accepted the probation at the time, though she now says she disputes them. She has spoken at recent meetings of the bar's Board of Governors and Discipline System Oversight Committee about discrimination in attorney discipline, and she said she is supporting an effort by the conservative lawmakers to strip the state bar of regulatory power. Wright pointed to an Arizona State University survey included in a recent issue of Arizona Attorney Magazine, an official state bar publication that found 45% of respondents felt there is a bias in the disciplinary system. The most commonly identified biases were against the type of law practiced and the size of a law firm. I do believe that the State Bar of Arizona has discriminated against attorneys of color. It's very well known. Individuals who own small law firms and individuals who are Republican, said Wright, who is black. When reached for comment, the State Bar said it categorically denies Ms. Wright's assertions, which are without substantiation. Her statements concerning the State Bar are not unlike the unsubstantiated claims made about a Superior Court judge that resulted in her being admonished and placed on probation. One of the cases that drew a bar complaint and discipline for Wright involved State Senator Catherine Miranda. On March 3rd, Miranda wrote a letter to the bar lauding Wright's representation and suggesting the bar punished her unjustly. Wright has courageously spoken out against systemic racial bias within the State Bar of Arizona, Miranda wrote, and it is highly troubling that her vocal advocacy appears to have been met with retaliatory actions. Joel F. England, the CEO and executive director of the State Bar, responded to Miranda in a March 6 letter, writing that her assertions that there is a lack of fairness or some other disparity in this process is entirely unfounded. Cope said Wright explained her issues with the State Bar to him and that he is comfortable with her representation. Wright said that she thinks the Suns are focusing on her to distract from the underlying claims brought by Cope and Trishan. I know what they're coming with, Wright said, when read the statement from the Suns. They're going to say, she's just a mess. She goes around starting problems all the time. This is what she does. Wright said she has two other clients who are in the process of preparing lawsuits against the Suns, and said many others have reached out but have been directed to other firms. At this point, my firm is the Phoenix Suns HR, she said. Florida-based attorney Courtney Walters is also representing Cope and Trishan in their cases, partly to help handle the load and to insulate them from attacks on Wright, which she expects to continue when future lawsuits are filed. They're going to run out of excuses, IBF law clerk Divine Holmes said. They're going to keep attacking Sherry. Sarver was forced to sell the Suns in an attempt to fix the toxic culture that he fostered, but Wright said she thinks the Ishiba-run Suns are so wary of bad press that they retaliate against anyone who reports discrimination. Cope is still working games and said little has changed for people who work there. The internal joke now, he said, is miss the Sarver days. Remember that if you've missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen. Next, a story written by TJ LeHeru and posted on March 20th. Report: Carrie Lake accosted Ruben Gallego at DC Club over cartel ties. Theoretically, one of the benefits of defeating Carrie Lake in a Senate race is not having to run into her in Washington, D.C. As Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego is learning, some theories don't hold water. According to reporting from The Bulwark, Gallego and Lake ran into each other as he was leaving Ned's Club, a D.C. social club that calls itself a place for diverse professionals to meet, work, and have a good time. The membership to join is $5,000 a year. The Bulwark reported the encounter happened sometime this winter, so it's unclear if Gallego had yet been sworn in as a senator or if Lake had begun her stint as a special advisor to the U.S. Agency for Global Media. Gallego told the outlet that he was on his way to the elevator when he crossed paths with Lake. He reached out to shake hands, and Lake placed both of her hands on his. How does it feel to be bought and paid for by the cartels? Lake asked, repeating an outlandish campaign trail allegation about Gallego's father, whom the senator has said left his family when he was a child, that earned applause at Lake's events. PolitiFact noted in October that the claim that Gallego had connections to the cartel was patently false. Gallego said Lake also asked him, how could you live with yourself every day? I'm like, easily, I won, and walked away, Gallego told The Bulwark. Gallego's office did not respond to her request for comment, nor did Lake and at the U.S. Agency for Global Media. As of Thursday afternoon, neither party had mentioned the incident on their respective social media channels. Lake might be too busy to post about that run-in. Recently, she's been signing a couple of papers to fire employees and dismantle USAGM, though it's unclear whether Lake had the authority to sign off on the massive cuts. When she's not Elon Musking her way around the department, she's pushing misinformation about fraud and waste on conservative news channels, soft focus camera and all. While the confrontation with Gallego reveals one thing about Lake's psyche, she's having trouble moving past her November defeat that pretty much branded Lake as a loser unfit for Arizona politics, it's telling in more than one way. The former TV news anchor has long been painted as a craven opportunist who jumped on the MAGA bandwagon as a shortcut to fame and power. But there were no cameras around when she grasped Gallego's hand and spouted a lie about his family to his face. Maybe she does believe the bullshit she says after all. Arizona kills Aaron Gunches in first death row execution in 2 years. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on March 19th. Shortly after 9 a.m. Wednesday, the state of Arizona executed death row inmate Aaron Gunches in a small chamber at the Arizona State Prison Complex, Florence. His killing by lethal injection was the first state execution in more than 2 years. Gunches was 53. Witnesses reported that Gunches shook his head no when asked if he had any last words. The Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry said the lethal injection of Gunches went smoothly and finished at 10:19 a.m. ADCRR estimated his time of death as 10:33, though media witness Troy Hayden of 12 News said Gunches appeared dead before that. By 10:18, media witnesses no longer saw movement in Gunches' chest, and his face lost its color. In 2004, Gunches pleaded guilty to kidnapping and first-degree murder in the 2002 killing of Ted Price, the former long-term partner of Gunches' then-girlfriend, Catherine Letcher. After driving Price into the desert, Gunches shot Price 3 times in the chest and once in the back of the head, later dumping the body on the Salt River Indian Reservation. Gunches was sentenced to death in 2008 and then again in 2013, after the Arizona Supreme Court found an error in the first sentencing proceeding. Nearly 23 years after the murder of Ted Price, Gunches walked to Arizona's death chamber. 5 employees escorted Gunches, who was wearing a white cotton jumpsuit and white socks, into the chamber. He did not look at the observation room where witnesses gathered. Among them, Attorney General Chris Mays, Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, and Price's younger sister, Karen Price. Gunches put up no fight as he was strapped to the table and as a white blanket was placed over his body. 4 staffers clad in white inserted IVs into both of his inner elbows. The IV went easily into his right arm. Media witnesses weren't so sure about the left arm. More than one staffer appeared to work to get the IV in. 8 syringes were in the room. The team used 4, a mix of green and black. Gunches had no visible reaction to the first black syringe. He reacted when the second syringe, a green one, was pushed. Media witnesses said Gunches' hands were taken by tremors. He began breathing heavily with a sound like a snore. He exhaled from his mouth with light wheezing and puffing sounds. Corina Lain, a law professor at the University of Richmond and lethal injection expert who wrote an amicus brief in Gunches' case, said that these symptoms are of acute pulmonary edema, which means that Gunches was essentially waterboarded to death. any execution that took just under 20 minutes, and has witnesses saying that he gasped for breath and snored, did not go fine, Lyene told New Times after the execution. I can assure you of that. The execution took 17 minutes, yet felt like an eternity, Arizona Mirror reporter and media witness Michael Kiefer said. He described the execution as the smoothest of the six he has seen, very uneventful. A little more than 30 minutes after entering the chamber, Gunches was dead. Afterward, Karen Price spoke to the media. Through tears, she expressed relief that it was over. When asked if she feels that she has justice, Price responded simply, "Yes, I do." "I don't think we ever thought this day would come," she said. "So it feels surreal." Experts doubt it was painless. Gunch's execution was the subject of controversy leading up to his death. Arizona has a troubled history with executions. The botched execution of Joseph Wood in 2014 led to an 8-year pause on executions, which resumed in 2022 under Republican Governor Doug Ducey. That year, Arizona executed 3 people, none of them without complications. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs paused executions when she took office in 2023, tasking retired federal judge David Duncan with reviewing the state's protocols. Late last year, Dobbs dismissed Duncan, who she said had exceeded his mandate. The governor then accepted the results of an internal review done by ADCRR, which concluded that executions could not proceed without issues. A draft of Duncan's review said differently. In it, Duncan identified issues with the storage of lethal injection drugs and the competency and payment of execution staff. He also suggested that while humane executions were theoretically possible, they appeared impossible in practice. After Duncan's dismissal, the state pushed forward with Gunch's execution. On February 11th, the Arizona Supreme Court issued a death warrant, setting his execution for March 19th. The court largely sidestepped questions about whether Arizona's execution protocols were humane. Lyene believes the execution of Gunches, mixed with the state's firing of Duncan after botched executions, will set up a textbook Eighth Amendment claim for future death row inmates who face execution in Arizona. They may claim that Arizona didn't take the necessary steps to ensure that its lethal injection system isn't cruel and unusual punishment, she argued. Arizona went for it anyway, and went forward with someone, Gunches, who did not test the system or challenge it, she said. Aaron Gunches didn't fight this claim, but the next guy will. While ADCRR reported no issues with Gunches' execution, experts doubt that his death was painless. Observers can't really know what an executed person feels in their last moments, said Nicholas Cote, an Arizona strategist for the anti-capital punishment group Conservatives Concerned. Cote said Gunches likely experienced extreme pain and suffering. Even lethal injection executions that do not appear to be visibly botched are still likely to be incredibly painful, if not torturous, Cote told New Times, whether that is apparent to witnesses or not. Duncan agreed. Once injected, phenobarbital causes acute pulmonary edema, which Lyene believes Gunches experienced. This will cause the capillaries in the lungs to burst, so the lungs fill with water, Duncan told New Times before Gunches' execution. A person's lungs will then weigh 4 times more than they should as they die, so they feel as if they're drowning. Even if it looks like it went well, we do not know what went on in the final moments of this man's life, whether it was humane or not, Duncan said. The mechanisms of his final moments won't be known until Gunch's autopsy. I don't know that we know more today than we did yesterday, Duncan told Phoenix New Times after Gunch's execution. We just don't know what the person was experiencing. Gunches did not challenge his own death order. Instead, he requested it, said Ryan McPhee, a a criminal defense attorney at Grand Canyon Law Group. McPhee was not involved in Gunch's case. Unlike past death row inmates in Arizona, Gunch's has mounted no efforts to avoid execution through stays or court battles, McPhee said. Gunch's represented himself throughout his death penalty trial, and Duncan worried that his lack of a legal team might have led to errors slipping through, as court proceedings have illuminated what is a very closed and non-transparent world. David Lish, also a criminal defense attorney at Grand Canyon Law Group, called Gunch's actions unusual and said his execution could be a bit of an outlier simply because it's coming at his urging and his request. That outlier nature may mean Gunch's death does not signal a new era of state executions in Arizona. Arizona has 111 death row inmates awaiting executions, including dozens who have exhausted all appeals. But Lish wouldn't be surprised if Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Hayes, both Democrats, don't push for another person to go to the death chamber. Are we going to start seeing a pattern of more executions? Probably not under Governor Hobbs and Attorney General Mays, Lish said, noting that executions don't occur as often under Democratic administrations. I don't believe that they're the type of folks that are going to be pushing for executions. Mays did briefly speak to the media after the execution. The death penalty is the law of the land in Arizona, she said. Today, Arizona resumed the death penalty. Arizona has a Native American suicide crisis. Here's why. This next story was written by Sahara Sajadi and was posted on March 19th. During the most vulnerable years of her young life, Kristen Paestua Picasso felt hopelessly alone. As a Navajo and Hopi girl growing up in Flagstaff, she was bullied by classmates because she was Native American. Her mother struggled with alcoholism and other mental health issues. Paestua Picasso struggled too, and felt that she had no one with whom she could share her burdens. She began to cut herself on her thighs and eventually her wrists, rationalizing that she was taking control of my mental health by taking it out on myself. By 16, she made peace with the possibility that one wrong cut could end her life. Anything to make her psychic pain fade away. When her stepfather discovered her cuts and urged her to stop, shame consumed her. She stopped eating and became dangerously thin. When she nearly passed out at her high school graduation, her grandmother begged her to eat and to heal. Paestua Picasso ate, but she also drank. By 20, alcohol had become a problem. Deep down, she knew that she was trying to die. It wasn't until Paestua Picasso turned 24 and met her now husband that she finally sought help. She has steered out of the skid that defined her adolescent years, but to that point, her story had been an all-too-common tale among Native Americans. In Arizona, indigenous people, those that belong to the American Indian and Alaska Native demographics, as tracked by the Arizona Department of Health Services, kill themselves at a far higher rate than the overall population. Last year, there were 31.9 suicides per 100,000 indigenous people in the state, compared to an overall rate of just 19.7 per 100,000 Arizona residents. That was actually a slight dip in Native suicides from 2023, when the rate was 35 per 100,000. In Arizona, no other racial demographic comes close. Those numbers signal a crisis, and one that has persisted in Arizona for years. In 2022, the State Health Department outlined a plan to collaborate with tribal leadership and other agencies to support mental health initiatives in Maricopa County and surrounding areas. Native Americans' suicide rate may have dipped, but it's still devastatingly high. The reasons for that are several. Discussing mental health remains taboo for many, and those who do seek help, especially those living in tribal communities, find that care facilities are too far away. When they make the trek, they too often find doctors who aren't native and are not able to bridge cultural divides. Too many obstacles. Darian Fuller remembers going to an Indian Health Services facility as a child growing up on the Navajo Reservation. The drive was long, as were the wait times. The staff weren't native and didn't look like her. Could she trust them? It was scary, rushed, and not very comforting, said Fuller, a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi and Diné tribes. A little kid is scared of all the noises. It was very cold, and it didn't feel like a very safe place to go and seek care. The native suicide rate is stark evidence that barriers are real. Addressing it requires specialized attention, which appears less likely over the next 4 years. What comes next for Indigenous communities is unclear. If outside help evaporates, if IHS is gutted, if important funding is clawed back, Native advocates will do their best to confront their community's suicide crisis alone. I am nervous for the future of public health for these next 4 years. It's not an easy time to be in public health, Fuller said. But I think that with the knowledge that we have built, we have the resilience and the tools we need. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.